Welcome to Wild Tracker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is the 17th episode. Wild Tracker is a series of podcasts, a writer's notebook, audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews with fascinating people, reflections, original radio plays, reportage, stories behind stories, jam sessions, and more. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. In today's podcast, I would like to share with you what it's been like making my feature film, The Blinding Sea. This is an independent film, which means that I've produced, directed, filmed, and narrated it, and also undertook the research and conducted the interviews. I'm dissatisfied with run-of-the-mill documentaries and fiction films. I find many films nowadays repetitive, predictable, derivative, full of overhyped scenes, as if they reduced everything to the lowest common denominator. In The Blinding Sea, I've deliberately chosen to tell a story which nobody has really heard before, the life, joys, sorrows, and death of the Norwegian polar explorer Roald Amundsen, who lived from 1872 to 1928. He was the first to navigate through the Northwest Passage between Greenland and Alaska, north of Canada. He was the first to lead an expedition to the South Pole. He was one of the first to get through the Northeast Passage between Norway and Alaska along the north coast of Siberia, and he was the first confirmed to have made it to the North Pole. I'm also bringing out a book in conjunction with the film, and I'm calling it The Blinding Sea, an experiment in biography. I would like to say a few words about my methodology in making the film. This is not some armchair vision of polar exploration a century or more ago, as if all I had to do was look up facts in libraries, then acquire stock footage to tell the story. Amundsen and his contemporaries wrote exploration narratives, or had ghostwriters do it for them. They transformed the stories of their expeditions into compelling epic tales. What they wrote is an important part of the historical record, but but there's no point simply repeating what they said or wrote in their own lifetimes, because much of it glorified their expeditions and served to help them pay the costs of each expedition or to finance the next one. Amundsen left nobody indifferent. He's variously been portrayed as a world-class genius, a world historical figure, a jerk, a hero, and a villain, the protagonist of his own life story, and the antagonist thwarting and forestalling his great rival, Robert Falcon Scott. I wanted to get beyond the glamour and propaganda, the myth-making and the myth-breaking, the caricatures in broad brushstrokes, to find out what kind of person Amundsen really was, what mattered to him, what impact he had. Of course, the film is based partly on the written record, but I also conducted interviews, which means the film is based partly on oral histories. I already knew how to conduct interviews from my 20 years of work for print and broadcasting media. I must have interviewed 15,000 people, often in cross-cultural settings. I conducted interviews for the film as well. But oral histories are quite different from straightforward factual interviews. It takes time and effort to gain the trust of people when you're doing an oral history. I tracked down descendants of great polar explorers from a century and more ago to incorporate oral histories into the film. The great-niece and great-nephew of Amundsen in Norway, the grandson of Adrien de Gerlache, the Belgian polar explorer, the grandsons of Robert Falcon Scott and Teddy Evans, the British polar explorers, the granddaughter of Sir Ernest Shackleton, the Anglo-Irish polar explorer. As I moved along, gathering more and more material about Amundsen, I realized a huge part of his life story was missing. And this was the relationships Amundsen cultivated with Canadian Inuit and Siberian Chukchi during his expeditions. I tracked down a clan in Arctic Canada, descended from Kudlyuk, a woman who traveled by dog team with Amundsen for weeks at a time and knew him well enough for her parents to formally propose marriage to him. Also, remembering that Amundsen legally adopted a Siberian Chukchi girl named Kakunita, I was lucky enough to track down Kakunita's daughter for several interviews. She's therefore Amundsen's granddaughter by adoption. I interviewed a few experts in the film, such as ship captains, but this is a film in action, with people on camera directly involved in the story or possessing skills that demonstrate what Amundsen and his contemporaries accomplished. This is not a film about people whose academic interest is simply interpreting what other people are doing with their lives. Then again, I'm fascinated by science and especially the health sciences. I have a doctorate from McGill University in the history and philosophy of science, so this made me comfortable investigating what people meant by knowledge a century and more ago, why some polar explorers preferred science to the folk wisdom of Aboriginal people, even when the folk wisdom worked and the science did not, and how this lack of access to folk wisdom proved fatal for some of them. Roald Amundsen, on the other hand, was willing to learn new knowledge paradigms from Aboriginal Inuit. I also spent a postgraduate year studying medical science at Oxford University. This background in medical science helped me to highlight the role of physical and psychological health for polar explorers and Aboriginals alike. The Blinding Sea is a documentary. It's very important to find new evidence and to interpret it in documentaries. During the research phase of the film, I gave guest lectures at different universities in Europe and North America to validate my findings before well-informed critical audiences. For example, I gave 2 guest lectures at the Scott Polar Research Institute at Cambridge University and another one at the Sorbonne in Paris. I showed an early draft of the film at the University of Vermont, then at the Bird Polar Research Center at Ohio State University. I treated these interactions like focus groups. They helped me get acquainted with a wide range of perspectives and political agendas. Some academics made valuable suggestions about avenues of research to pursue and gave me encouragement. Other academics astonished me with their aggressive attitude. They must have felt my research findings undermined their own work or threatened the ideological positions they were defending. But methodology in a film means seeing the story with the camera. Making a film, especially a feature-length film lasting 1 hour 48 minutes, means showing viewers the adventure of knowledge in Amundsen's day, the risk of navigating on the polar seas before the shape of continents was known, before regular ice reports via satellite or the internet existed. It means showing viewers what it's like to lead dog teams and to ski in deep snow and to hike on glaciers wearing crampons and to wonder at the beauty of the Northern Lights. Making a film requires showing the story because there's simply no point describing a scene if there's no supporting image. Storytelling in a film begins with the image. Now, writing a newspaper story means taking mental notes and jotting down quotes to write up later. A newspaper story can be written with pen and paper in hand. Doing a radio story means recording sound, building up rapport with people if you're doing interviews, and enabling them to tell their story the best they possibly can. Making a film is far more complex than that. It involves seeing with the camera, crafting a story in terms of images, not just words on paper or sound bites, filming people in the right light without too much ambient sound to distract the viewer's attention, gaining their trust and cooperation, since their body language will betray any lack of trust or even any lack of self-confidence on their part. And it's best to show people doing things, being expressive, using their hands and eyes to communicate, and performing tasks. Filmmaking requires well-defined scenes, beautifully shot, good sound, a steady camera able to follow movement. Because of all these aspects of filmmaking and the costs of equipment and film crews, many people shooting documentaries script everything out in advance and then dictate to the people appearing on camera what they're expected to say. I disagree with this approach. If I'm filming someone special, it is because they are special, not because they conform to my image of them. My job is to help them communicate their views as effectively as possible. Everything began when I was sent on assignment to the Beaufort Sea to do a one-hour documentary for CBC Radio on board the Canadian research icebreaker Amundsen in the depth of winter. I also wrote a series of articles about this experience for the Montreal newspaper Le Devoir. My son-in-law Adam Shamash told me I could not possibly spend 3 weeks on an icebreaker way above the Arctic Circle without buying a video camera and starting to film whatever I saw. "But what's the story?" I asked him. "You can always decide that later," he said. "Just start filming. The story will come to you." He took me to the best camera shop in Montreal and helped me choose the best gear for the journey. At the beginning, I had no experience shooting video, and I didn't even know how to use a video camera or record sound in conjunction with a camera. In the course of making the film, I upgraded my cameras from high definition to 4K, although the end product is 1080p, so that's high definition. I threw myself time and again into extreme environments, forming an accurate picture in my mind of what I needed, and then capturing clean footage and clean sound was very challenging. Sometimes I had no idea what I was filming. An opportunity arose, the light seemed perfect in the wilderness, and I just filmed like crazy from every possible angle and using every lens I had. I remember going by helicopter from Inuvik up to the icebreaker Amundsen, frozen into the endless ice pack. The ship seemed so lonely, so unnatural, so vulnerable, as if marooned at the ends of the earth. How would I rise to the challenge of filming in air temperatures of minus 48 degrees Celsius? That's minus 54 degrees Fahrenheit. And that was even without factoring in wind chill. What if my camera froze while I was a few nautical miles out on the ice? What if I froze? What if marauding polar bears decided to have us for lunch? Then, once we got underway again, the ship blasted her way through the ice, pulverizing it, sending up bursts of incredibly dry salt spray. This went on for hours at a time with a banging, booming sound like smashing copper pots and pans together. It set my body throbbing in daytime and disrupted my sleep at night. But the ice itself fought back, breaking up into symmetrical blocks, by turns roaring and shivering as it clawed its way along the hull, shrieking like some crazed dragon falling from the sky. The deck lurched and shuddered during this onslaught on the ice. It was certainly hard to hold the camera steady, let alone remain standing. How would I film this without weakening my raw footage with excessive movement? Or was the movement itself an integral part of the story? Then there came the moment when I accepted this was another world. I no longer resisted the high Arctic. I now fell strangely silent. I remember I was on the bridge at the time. The windows were frosted over, and I could just make out in the dusk, as a downdraft of smoke swirled from the funnel, the name of the ship, the Amundsen. Experiences like this, adjusting to the extremes of polar environments, dealing with disorientation, uncertainty, and even moments of fear, helped me understand what was at stake for Roald Amundsen and other people of his era. It also helped me get the story, seeing everything with my camera. Wandering around the corridors of the icebreaker got me thinking about the explorer after whom the ship is named. Amundsen lived at a completely different time from our own. I wondered whether I could build a story and tell it in a narrative film by giving viewers a powerful impression of his life, the way it really was. This meant going to places key to the story, reconstituting events, reliving what Amundsen and other people may have experienced then, getting a sense of the challenges, hopes, fears, anguish they felt, and the life or death decisions that confronted them. In The Blinding Sea, I provide an eyewitness account of harsh polar environments. From across the Arctic to Antarctica, I risked my health and even my life time and again to get the best footage. And as the name The Blinding Sea implies, much of the film was made at sea. First, on board the icebreaker Amundsen on the Beaufort Sea south of Banks Island in the high Arctic region of Canada, and then on the Dutch three-masted bark Europa, sailing on the Southern Ocean from Tierra del Fuego to Antarctica and back again. There were moments of sheer wonder. I'm thinking of the time the research icebreaker Amundsen got stuck in 3-meter-thick ice ridges, that's 9 feet, and it took about 20 crew members a few hours to drill holes in the ice around the ship, then connect all these dots by using chainsaws. The captain reversed engines a few times to send ballast up onto this weakened ice to break it up and finally to get the ship free. I also remember nights on the deck of the 3-masted bark Europa on the Southern Ocean between Tierra del Fuego and the Antarctic Peninsula, the wind in the rigging, waves rushing by in the darkness, under a night sky full of brilliant, shimmering stars. While shooting the film, I had to keep an eye on my psychological health. And the first psychological problem I faced in the polar regions was disorientation. For example, on the tall ship, tossed this way and that on the Southern Ocean, how should I film the movement of the ship? A movie is, after all, a moving picture, but I'd never seen such a crazy stretch of sea. Would I get so disoriented by waves rolling along the hull and sometimes up onto the deck that I simply forgot to clean drips of salt water off the lens? What if condensation clouded up my camera when my mind was distracted? Some other people on board, coming out onto the roller coaster deck, would vomit out of control. There, right where they stood. Fortunately, I don't get seasick. If I wanted to represent my own disorientation on video as part of the story, how best should I do this? I had to take care of my own physical health while shooting the film. For example, I remember in one scene I shot in Joehaven, Nunavut, in the Canadian Arctic. It was February, and the sun had just returned above the horizon after the 6-week polar night. George Kanana, the Inuk great-grandson of Kudliuk, a woman who'd been keenly interested in Roald Amundsen, dressed up in furs and got his dog team ready for filming on the ice pack down on the sea. The only problem was, I'm not used to working outdoors during Arctic winters. The air temperature was minus 54 degrees centigrade. That's minus 65 degrees Fahrenheit. And the wind chill was minus 68.3 degrees centigrade, or minus 91 degrees Fahrenheit. It's well known that Inuit resist cold far better than southern Canadians do, which is why George Kanana was teasing me about the cold. He kidded me after an hour or two, asking why I was so eager to head back inside. Actually, my camera had completely frozen, The plasma screen had turned to ooze. The motor was dead. The lens was covered with ice crystals. My backup camera under my parka was completely covered with condensation from my body moisture. And when I took the camera out from under my parka, the condensation frosted up. Besides, I could no longer move my fingers. I'd taken off my gloves for a moment or two in order to adjust my lenses, but this meant getting such severe frostbite on 9 of my 10 fingers that they became like chopsticks afterwards. I couldn't bend my fingers for 3 weeks. Well, it was all in a day's work. One of those cameras died shortly afterwards, and I replaced it with a few others. And yet, I find that this particular scene is one of the most compelling and most beautiful in the film, so it was worth it, I guess. Yes, the first camera froze and died. The second camera was covered with thick frost and unusable. My batteries drained away in the extreme cold. I would have to bring along fully charged spares next time and find innovative ways to keep lenses clean, because dry or wet salt spots could ruin any footage I got. I would have to take into account the movement of the camera, since there's nothing worse than bumpy footage outdoors, especially when you only have one chance to shoot it. Another time in Joehaven, Nunavut, I got an acceleration concussion while sitting on a sled drawn at high speed by a snowmobile for 10 hours. The ice surface beneath us felt hard like steel, and it was inevitable I should get the concussion since I was hammered up and down all day long. And then there were unexpectedly funny moments. I remember setting up an expensive camera on an ultralight tripod to film the ripples on the surface of a mountain lake in Norway, when suddenly a powerful gust of wind knocked the tripod over and my camera tumbled into the lake. I dove in to recover it, and fortunately, I'm not too sure how, the camera survived intact. Another time I was on a dog sled, filming the huskies ahead of me as they raced this way and that in the snows of Kluane National Park in the Yukon. The huskies decided to dart in between two low-lying bushes. The dog musher behind me lost control. One runner underneath the sled snagged a bush and the dog sled keeled over, me along with it. Another time I met a man walking around Nome, Alaska with a pet reindeer on a leash. That seemed to be a huge pet to be leading around. It was also funny filming wildlife, since I didn't always get the results I was looking for. A herd of muskox was just about to take a run at me, so I hid behind some rocks. Gentoo penguins waddled up to me on a beach in Antarctica and nibbled on my thick boots. And filming polar bears, whales, dolphins, and albatrosses exposed me to the challenges of filming powerful animals on the loose, changing directions when they wanted to, including bearing in on me. Unfortunately, several key people I encountered along the way died before the production was completed. The person who invited me onto the icebreaker Amundsen died in a terrible plane crash. I did an interesting interview with another person on the icebreaker, but he died shortly afterwards in a helicopter crash, so I couldn't use that interview footage. I interviewed another person several times, who then disappeared without trace, and may well have died for all I know. There was also an extremely difficult moment in making the film that had nothing to do with weather conditions or filming from a helicopter, snowmobile, three-masted bark, icebreaker, dog team, or while skiing, snowshoeing, or glacier hiking with crampons. It had nothing to do even with the occasional aggressive behavior of wild animals. No, this extremely difficult moment came when I suddenly had so much material, I didn't know what to do next. I still felt well short of the final goal, which was bringing out a feature-length documentary. I was simply tied up in knots. I uncovered so much previously unknown evidence about Roald Amundsen and his contemporaries that my creative process got all tangled. A harrowing experience, but somehow strangely familiar. It was like doing my doctorate at McGill University all over again. I'd come to the point when facts, and more facts had built up, as if I were making spaghetti for 25 people in one enormous pot. But then, someone mischievous must have emptied the pot all over the floor. I'd cooked it far too long in any case, so it was all pretty limp spaghetti, and I had to disentangle everything, figure out which strand should be connected to which other strand to form a coherent whole. This happened with the blinding sea as well. Suddenly, I had a dream. Alfred Hitchcock came to me in my dream and said, "You have elements in your film which remind you of me. Victorian iconography, dreams, pre-Raphaelite portraits of women, haunted castles, Edgar Allan Poe, suspense, terror, and vertigo, encounters with wild animals, elements from Gothic novels showing indescribably tiny people lost in grandiose landscapes, the tragic hero. Listen, I know you're unable to bring all of this together to create a narrative unity. Your material is tremendous, though. Would you accept that I take over direction of your film and pull it all together? I'm good at that. Don't worry, we can share credit as directors." This dream came as a huge surprise. I took notes as soon as I woke up in the morning. Hitchcock also said to me, "Your story should be pushed along by elemental emotions, excitement, love, desire, fear, hatred, hunger, disgust, terror, thirst, pride, shame. You know, in researching this film, I've heard the wildest claims being made about Roald Amundsen, as if he'd been either the greatest world historical figure from a small country who ever lived, or the nastiest scheming arch-villain of all time. Some people out there, including some museums, seize on what they call facts to control an ongoing narrative. Of course, when you do a documentary film, you have to get your facts straight, but there's far more to a story than just facts. The viewing public relates to emotions and storytelling. At each moment, intuitively, the viewers ask how the story they see unfolding on the screen actually relates to their own lives. They ask what they would have done had they been placed in Roald Amundsen or Robert Falcon Scott's situation. I mean courage, love, survival, fear, and sacrifice resonate with all of us. Dan Owler wrote a great book called Hitchcock's Notebooks, which quotes Hitch as saying, "The motion picture is not an arena for a display of techniques. It is, rather, a method of telling a story in which techniques, beauty, the virtuosity of the camera, everything must be sacrificed or compromised when it gets in the way of the story itself." Hitchcock also says, "A film tells a story cinematically, through a series of images and settings and backgrounds." The way I read this is, the evidence you uncover supports the story, but a film is far more than just evidence. The Blinding Sea is not simply a nature film. It is, above all, a film about the interactions of people and animals in extreme polar environments and the quest for understanding, the sharing of knowledge and wisdom between different cultures. This is a gripping adventure film where the adventure is knowledge, the pursuit of new knowledge and discovery, and what it means to live in other cultures for years at a time and form fruitful relationships. Making the film has been high adventure for me. I would like to thank two people in particular for their contributions to this film. Marie Frenette, who has provided insight, suggestions, sound recording facilities, and her incredible singing voice for the soundtrack. And Guillaume Falardeau, who's done a fantastic, painstaking, inspired job as video editor. If you would like to know more about my ongoing creative works, from books, translations, films, and blogs to Wild Trekker, check out my author's website at www.evidencia.net, and Evidencia spelled E-V-I-D-E-N as in normal, T-I-A. The opening theme at the beginning of each Wild Trekker podcast is sung by Marie Frenette, with me accompanying her on the piano. Now, here's Marie Frenette singing the closing theme of Wild Trekker, accompanied by Pascal Desmels on the guitar. Let's get together soon. This Wild Trekker episode is copyright 2020, George Toombs, all rights reserved.